TCS Legends is powered by Mitel for all your unified communications and customer experience needs. Visit mitel.com. I'm Duncan McLeod. Welcome to TCS Legends, the podcast series from Tech Central that, as the name implies, chats to or about some of the legends who helped South Africa's tech industry become what it is today. And we have a great guest today, all the way from Boston, Massachusetts. But before I introduce him to you, let me tell you that you can subscribe to this show on YouTube. You can do that at youtube.com/TechCentral, and you'll never miss an episode if you hit that bell icon. And we have a ton of great interviews still to come on TCS Legends, so please do get subscribed today. Now, I'm very excited to introduce my next guest to you today. David Frankel was one-time chief executive of Internet Solutions with Alon Aptek. You might remember that name too. And of course, a pioneer of the early internet in South Africa. What you might not know is that David has gone on to a very successful investing career in the US, where he is co-founder and CEO of a company called Founder Collective, a seed stage venture capital fund that has invested in some pretty big name successes in tech, among them Uber Technologies. David, it's really awesome to see you all the way from the US East Coast. How is life in the US?
Duncan, thanks so much. And honestly, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about some of the folks who I think are legends. And it's great to be with you. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous spring day here in Boston. So you couldn't have chosen a finer morning for me.
Fantastic. How long have you been in Boston now?
We've been back here for coming up for 16 years now. So came at the beginning of 2009. So 15 and a half years. But I was here for school. I was lucky enough to come here for business school, actually after the IS chapter. So it was a wonderful break in a way in terms of career change. So I owe a lot to the city, and we've been very happy here.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about your time at Harvard Business School and the founding of Founder Collective, but let's go right back. And David, I was amazed, a bit of history about you that I actually didn't know, found out in my research, that your great paternal great-grandfather, Jacob Frankel, founded a little company called Tiger Oatery, which went on to become Tiger Brands. Is your family still involved at all in Tiger Brands?
No, the family hasn't been involved really since I was a teenager, but my grandfather, Rudy Frankel, was truly the force there. His father, Jacob, died, unfortunately, when Rudy was on his way to Oxford, and he had to take over what was this tiny family business. As I understand it, two wagons and some donkeys that delivered feed to the mines. And he took that and turned that into what became Tiger Oats. So I was incredibly lucky to have these wonderful mentors around me, both of my grandfathers, and certainly Rudy. By the time I came of age, Rudy had more time. And I would go on vacation with him and my grandmother, may she rest in peace, and have wonderful walks together. So I was lucky to have these business mentors who had patience and time for me.
Okay. And do you think that has contributed significantly to your successes in life?
I do. I think that I look at my wife and her grandfather and father and brother are all physicians. They're not all now, but she grew up in a very medical family. I remember early on in our courtship, I would speak a lot to her mom because we were the only two that weren't doctors at the dinner table. But I think the fact that commerce and business was such a big part of our family dinner conversation certainly contributed to where I would seek to spend my time professionally.
Great. Well, David, I was actually trying to think back in preparing for this discussion today about when we first met, and I think it was probably in around March or April of 1994 when you just joined Internet Solutions, and I'd actually just begun my career in tech journalism. I remember, in fact, you weren't the first person at IS that I met. Ronnie Aptek was the first person I met. He actually came to install.
What's very scary? is we're literally you and I having our 30-year anniversary here. It's quite something. Isn't that insane?
That's true. It is 30 years. That's right. I didn't think of that. Yeah, 30 years ago. But as I was saying, Ronnie was the guy I met first, because he came to install the internet at Systems Publishers, which I was working at the time. I think we were one of the first companies in Johannesburg actually to get connected by internet solutions. And Ronnie personally came and set it up on I think it was an old Sun Unix workstation we had at the offices. And we started using the internet, and it was a groundbreaking time. Just take us back. You were working at Altec at the time, if I recall correctly, and then you got the call to come across to IES. Tell us about how that happened, and maybe share a few insights and anecdotes into those first few months at Internet Solutions.
Yeah, spot on. So you have to rewind a little back from that, probably a year or two, and Ronnie's brother Alon and I were at school together, and we were business partners probably from the age of about 15. We were at the flea market, kind of selling whatever moved, and Ronnie also had a stall at the flea market, but Alon and I had become friendly in primary school. So, and you know, Ronnie was Alon's older brother, who was much cooler and doing all sorts of things. And as we transitioned to college, Ronnie and I started to speak more. He was doing computer science. I was doing electrical engineering. The timing was impeccable because both departments had access to this thing called the internet. So, you know, by 1992, I was very conversant in what the internet was by then. Remember, that's crazily pre-Mosaic, pre the World Wide Web. But Ronnie and I could converse. Ronnie, in fact, got a small amount of money with three other guys. It was Philip Green, Tom McWalter, and Andra Salomon. And to basically connect UMDAL mainframes. So he was using the university internet access, and what they were doing at the very beginning, not even in a for-profit manner, was they figured that if you had an UMDAL mainframe and you needed a magnetic tape, to do the patches, they could do it quicker for you using the internet. And literally, again, this was using, you know, internet access via VITS. So Ronnie took a small amount of money. Very quickly, that investor, I think we're talking about 10,000 Rand or something, that investor, for some reason or another, wanted their money back. And Alon said to me, by the way, at Altec, I was... I think I can claim to be one of Ronnie's very first customers. Very early on, I was working for the chairman of the Altec Industrial Group, and I was doing quite a bit of work for Bill Fanta, actually. I was doing special projects for Bill and for Bill's son, Craig. And I remember early on bringing together the CTOs of the whole group so that Ronnie could give, and I literally have the disk still that Ronnie gave me, the stiffy disk, which says you hold the world in the palm of your hands. And I think I was one of the first people to... So we became a customer quickly. Alon said to me, you know, Ronnie's investor wants money back. This was in 93. So this was months after, you know, Ronnie was deciding to do this. By the way, for months after I joined, Ronnie still ran his stall at the flea market selling ties. So that gives you a sense of, like, we all had other options. And frankly, I had a very real option. Shortly after joining Altec, I knew I had a deferred admission to HBS, to Harvard Business School, and I had applied there. So we all had these backup options, and that gives you a sense of, you know, could this internet thing work? It just was not clear at that point, as crazy as that may sound. Later in 93, Ronnie's sole investor wanted all his money back for some reason or another. Alon came over to me and said, should we take over that investment? I decided to take a look. It was pretty clear that these were very good tech founders, but someone was going to have to manage it. And I volunteered. It was pretty risk-seeking at that time. I had this very interesting job. Bill Fanta had been incredibly kind to me, pulling me into board meetings, actually. I would sit in the corner and observe. So very demystifying. But this felt very exciting. And, you know, Alon and Ronnie, to me, even then, were pretty much a blank check. Cut a long story short, I went in and joined full time in March. So we took over the funding. We put in quite a bit more funding from Alon and I. So really going to the max of what we could afford to fund. And that had come from, frankly, profits that we had made working at the flea market for many years and a couple of other businesses that Alon and I had run together very happily. We were lucky to have that seed capital. But between the managing partners, the operating partners of Internet Solutions, we owned the whole company, which in today's world is more unique. Within about 4 or 5 months, the company was profitable, so kind of by fall of 94, and we were funding the company with willing customer revenues, which is ultimately the greatest way to fund a company. That's been a lesson for life. Interestingly, there was one more player, a guy, Philip Green, who I think looked at this and went, this thing's not going to work. He left, went to, I think it was Datatech. And, you know, it was risky at the time. Mm-hmm. But you know, very quickly, we epitomized right place, right time, because the access business was working well. And of course, you know, 30 years ago, we had call options on a whole lot of wonderful businesses. So we started a security business, a hosting business, a web development business, an integration business where we were integrating into SAP backends pretty quickly, where we were building bank websites. You know, we started HealthBridge, for instance, and HealthBridge was very much a bits instead of atoms business, but we can't compete with our banking customers. That became a large business. In fact, with TML, we started a business which was Bridge and a kind of Reuters competitor. We started a browser called Anansi, a search engine. So there were so many call options. By the way, I would say the best of those call options still were the hosting business was excellent, the security business, and you know our margin on the core bandwidth business was exceptionally good. In retrospect, we should have just focused like crazy on that. But of course, you may remember we were coming under a lot of fire from Telkom. So, you know, Telkom was very, very much behind the curve. And you had government as kind of owner, regulator, and judge of this whole matter. So at that point, we went very public in terms of trying to defend ourselves. We really used the press as the theater of public opinion, I guess, in terms of how this
would
play out.
Yes, and I remember that fight quite vividly. In fact, you were the co-chairman of the Internet Service Providers Association at the time, which I think was actually founded to fight Telkom, if I'm not mistaken. You were co-chair with Mark Todes. Mark Todes. Yes. Well, he's still based in Cape Town.
He is. What a wonderful guy. And we were fiercely competitive, but it was one of those moments where we came together and about another 40 participants joined us to try and galvanize action against Telkom. And, you know, Telkom, if they'd had their way, certainly would have thwarted the commercial or the advent or the trajectory of commercial internet access in South Africa.
I think a lot of people have actually forgotten about that story and exactly what Telkom was looking to do. They just sold 30% to a strategic equity partner made up of SBC, which is now AT&T, and Telekom Malaysia. And they were being run by a fairly sophisticated American leadership team who came in and were basically saying the government has given us a bunch of rights exclusivity in order to roll out telephone services into underserviced areas. And those rights should extend to include the internet protocol. So effectively, they wanted to monopolize the internet in South Africa. What do you think would have been the outcome if they'd been successful to the development of the internet in South Africa?
It would have just been far slower, far more expensive. Clearly, lack all objectivity on this, but really it came down to the right to multiplex. So, you know, the idea would be, look, I buy a lease line, I can do whatever I want with that lease line. And whether this qualified as resale, I think to a degree it was resale, but the irony was that we were in many ways a glorified distributor for Telkom. We were such an accelerant and such a exceptionally motivated sales team for Telkom that they did very well out of having commercial ISPs were kind of like, you know, think of them as cellular resellers. At the end of the day, Telkom still owned the underlying infrastructure. In fact, we pushed the envelope more and more and more. Eventually, we were putting in our own microwave connections, saying, look, they couldn't move as quickly as us. And we'd offer, certainly in terms of line of sight, we'd offer microwave connections until they could come up and run. And so there's no question we pushed the envelope, but I think in a way that was very good for the country, very good for the consumer. And had South Africa kind of very far ahead for a country that was so geographically, far away from the major hubs.
It was certainly an interesting time, but eventually ISPO won that battle. How did it end in the end? I've forgotten.
No, it kind of just kept on going. There was detente, and I think eventually, really, Telkom ran out of steam. There was no real judgment. We got one favorable judgment, but it was always with caveats, and yet we just kept pushing. The most important thing was that Telkom did not get their cease and desist request. So Telkom continually were lodging cease and desist. But I remember, we brought in and ISPA enabled us putting this together as an association where we were all co-funding because there was no way we could outspend Telkom alone. ISPA allowed us to bring in some serious legal heavyweights. So I remember going up and down to Pretoria with Michael Katz, who was the chairman of ENS. And Michael was a signal as much as anything that we were not going to take this lying down. But the bottom line was Telkom never got their cease and desist request through.
Did you ever make friends with any of those Telkom guys, or was it, in hindsight, did you ever?
Much later on in a different lifetime. So and Dealey and Carver became a very important and good partner and good friend. So, we put up this satellite, with this Africa-only satellite together, where Andili's consortium, of which I was very luckily a participant, we owned 25% and Intelsat owned 75%. It was a wonderful, wonderful journey. But I did that actually post-business school. My partner at the time, a guy Paul Salomon, we were sitting with Andili and his team, I think at the ENS offices, and Adili literally said, like, why don't we put a satellite up? And from that, the whole team, we were literally in French Guiana watching the satellite launch together, and that happened.
Yeah.
So Adili became a terrific partner, and, I stayed very close to a bunch of people. I never became terribly friendly with the Telkom folks.
Okay. But you're still friends with many of the guys from the IS days. I believe you're still very close to Ronnie and to Alon. How often do you chat to them, and what are they up to these days?
Yeah, so Alon is one of my dearest friends in the world still. We'll use any opportunity to see him. I was together with him in Cape Town a month ago. We had the most beautiful walk on the mountain together, reminiscing, beautiful dinner at his place. He spent a ton of time. Him and his wife, Lisa, have stayed with me in Boston. So, all truly, truly one of the greatest humans in the world. Alon has gone on, amongst other fantastic accomplishments, Alon has become one of the top bridge players in the world. Ronnie went on to make movies, get involved in other tech startups, went on a wild adventure. He is a unique, special human. So Ronnie ended up spending more and more time in the Ukraine and Kyiv. Married this fantastic woman, and they have a son together, David, affectionately known as the Bun Man. And in fact, I was in touch with Ronnie this morning on WhatsApp. Of course, Ronnie's been caught up in the misery and the conflict of what is the whole Ukraine set up. He's made a documentary recently, which I think is very important, and he's trying to get buy-in and distribution for that documentary. I think it's one of his best pieces of work, and he's been a prolific filmmaker. But Ronnie is currently living in Poland and traveling back to Kyiv with some frequency. So I'm very much in touch with the two of them. Saki Masaikos, who was a very early hire, went on to become CEO of Internet Solutions and a senior executive at Dimension Data. What a wonderful human. I've had many, many breakfasts with him back in South Africa. As I say this to you, it's never enough. Brandon Spear, who was one of our top people, went on to have a really illustrious career in the United States with SAP and far beyond. So these were fantastic humans. And Lior Atti, who was chief financial officer, was the founder of SICOM in South Africa. He's gone on to become a pretty successful investor in the tech space in South Africa and beyond. And they've just had a very good exit in the U.S. So these are certainly Alon and Lior are among my closest friends in the world. Very much aspire to staying in touch with Ronnie. We have a fairly robust WhatsApp relationship. But some of the others I did lose touch with. So Tom McWalter, Andra Salomon, they went their own ways pretty quickly after we sold IS, which again feels like a lifetime ago. We sold IS nearly 24 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. How often do you return home, David?
Well, I've been to South Africa 3 times in the last 8 months. I have my brothers in Cape Town. My parents are in Johannesburg. And probably one of the most important galvanizers is my wife and I set up, our foundation set up a nonprofit called Next Up, nextup.org.za, which does a lot of work in 11 Houtsbosch in the teen unemployment space. So we take kids from high school and accelerate them into various programs. Maharishi actually is a very important partner of ours, Teddy Bletcher, and a whole bunch of partners. But the only mark of success that we have, the only milestone, is 18 months continuous employment. So we get back for that, for family. And frankly, it's a joy to get back to South Africa when we can.
Amazing. We spent some time in Olievenhout Bush just last month to go and have a look at a very interesting mesh internet project there, being run by Riot Network, which you're probably aware of. Very, very interesting stuff going on
there. Subhadri Naidu, who's our CEO there, is very, very special. And I think we're one of the biggest, one of the biggest nonprofits or one of the biggest foundation initiatives in that area.
Okay.
Very gratifying.
Good. So
we ideated this, and I'm finding, startups in the nonprofit world. I joke, I've got a lot of nonprofits, but most of them are not deliberate. Weren't deliberately nonprofit. But the deliberate nonprofits are very gratifying.
Yeah. Absolutely. Before we get on to Founder Collective, I just want to touch on the slice of history that involved Dimension Data. Because Dimension Data was key to the IS story and to your story as well. They originally invested in Internet Solutions, I think, in 1995, when they bought a quarter of the company and then later bought out 100%, I think, 2 years later. Just take us through the Dimension, your career at Dimension Data. You were involved in various activities there. In fact, I think you might even have been involved in the London IPO, if I'm not mistaken. Just take us through that history.
So, Duncan, the Dimension Data chapter was a wonderful one. The person I give the real credit to for finding us and being tenacious about doing something was Richard Kame, who is just one of the most strategically insightful people I know. And Richard's gone on to have a fantastic career in fiber. But at the time, we were also speaking to Investec and RMB. Paul Harris had actually come to see me. That was the beginning of what has become a very enjoyable friendship, and I would say more mentorship, where Paul has so kindly mentored me and early on asked me to join the RMB board, which has been an absolute joy. I've been involved with RMB and a successor after that, RMI and RMH, which was the holding company for all the insurance and all the banking interests, until most of those were distributed out. So I resigned about a year ago, but what a wonderful chapter. But back to Dimension Data, Richard Kame was responsible for them acquiring a 25% stake. They actually, at the same time, we gave them an option to buy another 25 plus one at market-related prices. In retrospect, I'm not sure that that was the best move, but they insisted on that, and I think it was very smart from their perspective. But by 97, it became clear that this needed to be binary, because we were competing with many other interests in the Dimension Data Group. So we had started web development and an integration business, which competed directly with a business that they had bought called SPL. There was no area of the Dimension Data Group that was off limits to us to compete with, as far as we were concerned. We were ambitious, aggressive, and we had a lot of call options, some of which were better than others, but we would go after everything. So we were butting heads a lot. And of course, in 97, they made an offer, and credit to Alon, because Alon negotiated this on our side, but certainly that our advisors thought was too good, too good to turn up. So that was the beginning of them buying 100% of the group. We took a lot of that in shares, and I would say we were more lucky than smart, because, the share price had been 6 Rand a share when they acquired us. That went to 19 Rand and then rocketed. And of course, that rocketed all the way up to the dot-com crash, where, Dimension Data's fortunes were very, you could overlap it with Cisco. And so the small amount that we had sold, we were very grateful for. And then, of course, you needed patience to wait out that. And that, frankly, by the end, Alon and I worked out our three-year service agreement. I was lucky to be asked to join the Dimension Data board. And this was pre the London listing. So I wouldn't say I was central to the London listing, but I did as I was told. And I did a lot of the work leading up to that. And post that was sent off to acquire companies in Southeast Asia, amongst other places. So was doing some acquisitions for Datacroft Asia, really in a way working for a guy, Pat Cormby, who was their M&A guy. And at a point, Dimension Data had very, very, very valuable paper. I think we were trading on a 90 PE. So we were buying whatever moved, some of which was good. So certainly the Datacroft acquisition was great. And then, the US acquisition was awful. So, but Proxicom. It raised about $1.8 billion. Yeah, Proxicom was a terrible acquisition.
It almost killed Dimension Data.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was terrible. I think in a way, Proxicom, look, you're a rowing boat on the ocean. Dimension Data, I stand to be corrected, but I think it became one of, if not the largest Cisco distributors in the world.
That's right.
The problem was that the margin on Cisco routers was dropping. So the margin was insane when they acquired us or invested 25%. It was a 50% margin maybe. And then the margin was like sub 10%. It was really box moving. And that's when Dimension Data Services business took over. But by the end of 2000, Alon and I, we'd done the acquisition was 97. And, by the end of 2000, we had left. And frankly, that was when, was when like the next chapter in my career began.
Yeah. Before we get onto that next chapter, though, there's one question I need to ask you, because I've heard the story told to me many times over the years, and I've never checked with the source. Was Jeremy Ord grooming you to be the CEO of Dimension Data? Did he see you as his successor? That's what I've been told many times.
I'm not sure. There was a moment when I came back from business school where I was offered the CEO job. And frankly, the senior exec at the time was all for that. And there were people on the board who I think were for that. I'm not really sure if Jeremy really had me in mind or viewed me as a stalking horse. I had board members who advised me at the time very strongly not to take that job. But to this day, I'm not sure. As I say, for posterity, I kept the offer letter. And Jeremy did meet with me and you know, offered me that position. But, you know, I think I'm not sure I was enough of an insider. And frankly, I think that Jeremy was I haven't been in touch with Jeremy for so many years, but a tremendously emotionally intelligent guy. And I think he saw that I would do things differently and wouldn't necessarily toe his line all the way. And maybe a little too disruptive, given that, you know, ultimately, you know, he was the founder and at the time, certainly the, you know, the de facto monarch of Dimension Data. So whatever his reasons for me ultimately not getting the job, and certainly myself, I think, being pretty clear in terms of what I would do if I got it, you know, at the time, I was quite disappointed, to be honest. It was one of the reasons coming back from business school we had stayed, but not for very long. But of course, he did me the most extraordinary favor.
Okay, well, let's talk about Founder Collective. You did an MBA at Harvard Business School. I believe the genesis of this business was really that you started investing in your classmates' startups. Is that right?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I went through this kind of existential crisis post-IS, wondering, you know, what else I would do with my life and my career. And Alon and I had taken offices. We'd made some private equity investments. Very quickly, he was making Bridge a full-time job, and that's paid off tremendously. And I was itching, and I had, you know, been lucky to get this deferred admit to HBS. And obviously I'd put it off enough times that call option was dead. But I remember in about March 2001 saying to my wife, I really do need to just change things up and put myself into a different zone altogether. And I reapplied. I remember submitting my application in March. It was the only business school I applied for. And much of it was like a literally start from scratch, do something difficult, and do something, frankly, where I wouldn't have regrets later on. So I was, at that point, I wasn't 30 yet, but it was still pushing me to the older end of the class. And, you know, the rest was kind of history. I got into HBS. I went there very quickly. I was like, oh my God, what have I done here? You know, went from this very freewheeling environment where I would literally be dispatched by Pat to go to Southeast Asia. I found myself in Malaysia, the Philippines, et cetera, acquiring companies and being able to move around very freely to this kind of sabbatical where I was even more free into boot camp. And I didn't know what I was doing there. The lucky savior of that was to meet some entrepreneurs. And there were few and far between, but I met these amazing, amazing folks like Chris Dixon, who would go on to have an extraordinary career. Chris is the founder and head of A16Z Crypto and has been a storied partner. He's the author most recently of Read, Write, Own. I had 2.5 hours with Chris and my partner, Micah Rosenblum, in Los Angeles about a month ago, just reminiscing and talking about all of the things in the world. But Chris and I went on to invest in about 14 companies together. I was lucky enough to give Chris his first term sheet and not all, but some of his seed funding for SiteAdvisor, which we sold very quickly, and then for Hunch. So Chris was amazing. I met my FC partners very early on. So I met Eric Paley and Micah Rosenblum. Eric was in my section at business school. Him and his wife became our closest couple friend to this day. Extraordinary friends. He's probably sitting next door. And you know, was lucky enough to give them their first capital. So I did. I gave probably of the folks who did startups out of HBS in my year, I gave most of them seed capital. And it was this amazing opportunity, Duncan. I was sitting in, you know, had a lot of time, had lunches, you know, schmoozed, played squash with these folks, just a lot of time to figure out who is this person. And I would say it informed a lot of my a lot of kind of what I think of as the way to invest at seed. But it was a formative time. By the way, we were doing a lot of seed investing out of Internet Solutions. So remember, a lot of startups were coming to see us because they wanted bandwidth and they wanted hosting. So we were a very desirable strategic partner. A lot of those investments went wrong, but it wasn't like I hadn't had practice at IS and already had backed a few folks. But post HBS, I went pretty wild. I made about 28 investments in Classmates and beyond pre-Founder Collective, and it was that track record that allowed us. You know, when Eric and I came together. So Eric was my first investment. Eric and Micah started a company called Bronte's, which was doing 3D intraoral scanning. So using no x-rays, using photography only. It was kind of, imagine an electric toothbrush, a big electric toothbrush that you moved around the mouth. And real time, it was rendering a 3D image of your mouth. Well, that has become the de facto way that crowns and other interventions now take place in the dental industry. You press a button, you know, and you send that to the lab and they fab from that. Well, Eric was these were total pioneers. So we funded that business. I was lucky enough to be this, you know, the sole seed capital, but these were classmates. Todd Kreiselman started Media Radar, arguably the most important SaaS sales business in the media industry. They've just acquired a division of Kantar. Victoria Brown started The Big Think. Kevin Barenblatt. I went on to just, you know, fund a lot of these wonderful people. The seeds of that started towards the end of my business school stay. And frankly, I did a bunch of things that were non-tech as well. So I had taken an incredible real estate class by Arthur Siegel, who was a doyen in the U.S. commercial development space. And together with Greg Sachs, we started Alchemy in South Africa when I got back, which is, you know, Anthony Orlovitz and Greg Sachs are responsible for truly changing the Sandton skyline. So we went on to develop businesses, properties like the Peregrine Bidvest building, the Sasol building we owned. So I went in many directions. The satellite business that I was mentioning earlier, Paul Salomon was my partner on that. Paul today runs part of the private equity interests of the Oppenheimer family. But the seed funding that had started in business school went on to create this career in the U.S. very quickly, where post-business school, a lot of my working life was already in the U.S. And as soon as we sold Bronte's, Eric and I started to speak about investing together. And that, the culmination of that was Founder Collective. But, you know, we agreed to start Founder Collective 5 years after I'd come back to South Africa and gone through some of the Dimension Data CEO thing. And was having a ball in South Africa doing the seed investing in the US. And it was it was August 2008. And of course, the world was, you know, falling over with Lehman. And by December 2008, some of our anchor investors, or those who we thought would be anchor investors, abandoned us for the best of reasons. So I arrived with my family, my very young family, back in the U.S. On February the 2nd, 2009. Eric and I had breakfast together, looked at each other, and I give him credit for saying, look, I've quit my job. You've come to live here. Let's give this the best try we can. And again, I was so lucky to be in the position of being able to volunteer original capital for Founder Collective and knowing one or two people who would match me or get involved. So we were tiny. We started Founder Collective with $30 million. That was the size of the fund. We increased that by another $20 million. But it was an insanely difficult fundraising environment for a new team, a brand new team with no track
record. It was just after the, it was the financial collapse that just happened, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were literally in the, you know, in the beginning of the financial collapse, or whenever. But Lehman had collapsed. So Lehman had gone.
Yes.
You know, the Fed had let Lehman go, and but you know it was an unbelievable time to be investing. Our vintage from 2010, I mean 2009. If you look back, just and I would say, Duncan, honestly, it is the story of my career is the amazing humans that I've been able to partner with, and to a large degree, luck and timing. Because you look back and you go, to have started a fund in 2009 and been ready with capital in 2010. You know, in 2010, Eric gave Uber its first institutional capital. So he was one of a handful of small check writers. So we were right there in the beginning. You know, well, Uber's market cap today, I haven't checked recently, but I think it's over $100 billion. We were in at the ground floor. Eric found a company called The Trade Desk, which was an ad tech business. Ad tech was very out of favor, but he invested in Jeff in 2010. I think it's fairly well known in public, but when that business IPO'd, we owned 12.5% of that business still, and Eric was on the board. Eric, I think of as a co-founder there, because Eric was involved with Jeff before Jeff even had a full-time CTO. Eric would be horrified with me for calling him a co-founder, but he was in that early. The Trade Desk today probably has a $30 or $40 billion market cap. I met Bom Kim, who started Coupang, which is the Amazon of Korea, 2010. That has a $35 billion market cap. We owned, you know, we owned our stake until the IPO. And then there are businesses today, even Fund One, and this is the crazy thing about how long I always say the earliest stage of venture is the longest stage. You're on that ride for a really long time. SeatGeek, which I was lucky enough to fund, we took the lion's share of that funding in 2010 as well, is a private company. You know, it's the second biggest ticketing company in the world today, still taking share from Ticketmaster at a crazy pace. By the way, there are these outcomes, but these journeys and these adventures with these amazing, amazing founders, that has been the gift of a lifetime. I mean, being PillPack, which we sold to Amazon for about $1 billion, PillPack was literally started, you know, I don't know, you know, 5 yards away from me at the desk. Elliot Cohen was here. So Elliot was, I should say, Elliot and TJ, Elliot was a summer associate. Wasn't started here, but Elliot was summer associate when they were putting that together, bought TJ, and again, we were the very first institutional capital. And it's a drug. The drug is these vicarious journeys with these amazing humans. You know, I owe so much to them. The latest one, I can talk about any one of these, but Suno, Mikey at Suno, if you haven't heard that before, remember you heard it here. Like Suno is this unbelievable startup that we got involved with. We put in the only capital at pre-seed a year ago.
So David, I wanted to ask, is there a theme to your investments as Founder Collective? You're obviously focused on the seed capital stage of VC, but are there specific areas in tech that you prefer to focus on, or is it across the board? Anything that's interesting?
It's very hard to be stage constrained, which has been a deliberate strategy of ours, to be in at the seed stage, and frankly, not to invest in every round. So we don't, we don't dollar average in, which is a very well understood VC strategy. We get in at the beginning and then we dilute generally alongside the founder. That has been a very deliberate strategy. It's hard to do that and be thematic. So there are outstanding thematic investors out there, whether it's fintech, you know, edtech, you name it. And there are times where I'm envious of them because you can get so deep and you know every company in the space. But ultimately, I'm delighted with our strategy. So we are anti-thematic. Our view is that extraordinary entrepreneurs will educate us and will take us to places that we would not have imagined, and that we are not the experts on which are the themes. I'd go as far as to say that thematic investing, in my view, tends to be rear view mirror investing. If you look at almost any sector, if you look at, you know, the sharing economy or transport as a theme, most of these businesses, I can give you theme after theme, the real action was 5 years ago. In fact, if you look at 2009, you could argue that Airbnb and Uber, both companies that we were lucky enough to be investors in, you know, were the hottest companies, the best. So sharing economy, where in fact the greatest investment in 2009 would have been Bitcoin, you know, hands down. Mm-hmm. So I have this view, and it's the view of our team, that themes are fodder for VCs raising funds, and for to some degree for media. It makes for interesting reading, but you know, you need to be ahead of the curve. And the joy of what I do, and I'd say the high of what I do, is knowing something before the world cares. If you ask me why I truly skip into work, wherever work may be, by the way, it's because there are, at any one time, despite difficult situations and situations that may not work out, there are two or three opportunities which I seem to know are working before the world cares. And, you know, we've got at least two or three of those right now, which will become really important companies, but they're not, you know, media or PR fodder yet.
Mm-hmm. How do you find your investee companies? Do they come to you, or do you actively go out looking for them?
It's both. So it's certainly being, you know, very, very peripherally aware. By now, look, there are a lot of seed funds. It's become a very competitive space. I would say there were maximum 1,000 funds in the US when we got started, maybe even 500, and far fewer doing institutional pre-seed. There's something like 4,000 funds. I used to joke that being a tech investor when we started was like, you know, having afternoon tea. Now it's like being a barista at rush hour. A brand and a reputation matters, and hopefully, you know, we've done something there, and our association with successful companies has probably been more important than anything else. I would say the reputation of my partners, Micah Rosenblum, you know, Eric Paley, Amanda Herson, their reputations are as good people, good investors, very helpful, and the first place you go when you need your follow-on round. So our strategy is, because we don't invest in round after round, we view it as completely our responsibility to help you get that next round of funding done, if that's what you need. So reputation and brand matters, but there's no question, Duncan, you still have to hustle. And, you know, I'll be at a board meeting and, you know, the CEO will say, or the CTO will say, we're using this company for, you know, now for payments. Really interesting. And I'll say, like, tell me more about that company and I will make a call. But I think if you lose your curiosity and if you lose your hustle, I'm not sure that you should be in this world anymore.
Now, the nature of the sort of investment also means that some investments flame out. How do you deal with those, and how do you know when the time is right to call it quits?
It's very rare that we're the ones calling it quits. So
okay.
I would say there are good failures and there are bad failures. The bad failures are when we invested, and I'm sure many investors will resonate with this. And even if you don't say it publicly, even if you don't say it to your partners, there's that little voice in your head that says, I really had misgivings. I like the what a lot, but I wasn't sure about the who. That to me is a bad way to fail. there are very good ways to fail where you go, look, I like the what, I love the team, and it didn't work out. And a lot of that has to do with timing. You know, sometimes you're just too early and the world just hasn't woken up. One of my classmates, a wonderful guy, his name is Bertrand Bodson, and I'll just tell you this to illustrate the point. I was lucky enough to give him capital for a business called Bragster. Intel Capital followed on from me. They put in about $10 million. This was a long time ago. This was probably 2005. So pre-coming back to the US, pre-founder collective. Bertrand hired a fantastic team. They really hustled. They just did everything they could and ultimately ran out of money. Bertrand went on, you know, to have an unbelievable career. He was hired by Amazon. So Amazon's Netflix competitor, he ran that. He ultimately ended up as chief digital officer. So C-suite for Novartis, one of the top five people at Novartis, until he was headhunted to run one of the most successful retail chains in the UK. So he's gone on to have an amazing career. Every time I think of that, I go, I got it right. You know, Bertrand and his team were superstars. The timing was just impossible. And, yeah. You know, 5-6 years later, you know, with the advent of companies like DraftKings, which was a different space, but sports betting and that, you know, Bragster could have become that. But we're just ahead of our time. I have done that many, many times. I will continue to do that. I will continue to get the timing wrong with terrific founders. And, you know, interestingly, there's a part of me that thinks, is our attrition rate high enough? You know, do we have enough failures? And part of me thinks we don't have enough failures. If you look at the FC portfolio, I would say, you know, there are the superstars and 80% of our portfolio, you know, will do okay or better. And, you know, there's a counter argument is, are you taking enough risk if you're not having these kind of failures? So by that, I mean good failures. Certainly, you know, again, there's only one kind of failure. I've been saying this for decades, and that's moral failure, right? Moral failure is tough to get, you know, is very hard to come back from. But the gift of the U.S. still in tech is that it's a very forgiving environment and a very risk-seeking environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's been the joy of being a participant in this tech ecosystem.
I know we're almost out of time, David, but just two final questions, if you'll allow me. You're based in Boston. Tech, certainly from the perspective of South Africa, the tech ecosystem or epicenter, rather, is Silicon Valley. How much time do you spend in Silicon Valley? And have you ever thought of relocating there?
So, look, we hoisted a flag in New York and Boston. We have offices in New York and Boston. We had an office in the Bay Area, which my partner, Micah Rosenblum, headed until just before COVID. We don't have an office there. We have wonderful, wonderful portfolio companies and partners there. And a lot of our companies today are hybrid or remote. And that's a whole discussion in itself because I am a large supporter of in-person at the beginning of startup. But certainly the post-COVID era has allowed more geographical breadth. But really, Founder Collective was started with New York and Boston in mind. So we've always had these Boston and New York offices, and we still have 81 Green in Soho has been a fixture for us in New York. And, you know, the office that I'm speaking to you from in Harvard Square was where we started off originally. These were deliberate. Certainly, this was deliberately chosen to be close to entrepreneurs, to be close to MIT and Harvard, and certainly accessible for entrepreneurs. So more crisply, Duncan, the Bay Area is the center of the universe for what I do. There's just no question. And I would say AI and the number, the proliferation of AI companies, this next wave is galvanizing that even more. You know, New York and Boston are both, and they vie, the two second biggest ecosystems in the world. So to give you a sense, you know, Israel, Startup Nation, is fantastically branded. But if you look at the market cap output, and forget years ago, even if you you know, slice it much more narrowly, say the last 5 years or companies that have started in the last 10 years, Boston is number two on the planet. Just to give you a sense, Boston is number two on the planet. There are massive companies, you know, out of Boston that you have no idea are out of Boston. But, you know, the travel industry, so TripAdvisor, Kayak, they're all out of Boston. Toast in the POS space. Wayfair, you know, which is, you know, Amazon for furniture. These are all, you know, and by the way, we're not even on biotech. So biotech, we're in the center of the universe. Kendall Square, one T-stop away from me, is the center of the universe for biotech. But just in tech, I'm speaking to you from the second largest ecosystem in the world, right? Boston. And then New York, you know, if you just look at like the tech output, so New York used to be about, you know, finance and media startups. But if you look at the very, very real tech startups that have come out of New York in recent years, New York is very real. So but based on market cap, and I can send you all of these stats, these are really serious ecosystems. What has played very well and very strategically for us is that when West Coast firms are looking for some kind of geographical diversification, they can cut us in for a small check. And that comes from us sharing opportunities with West Coast firms as well. And there are many, you know, many instances of that. So Shield AI, which is one of the two, Anduril and Shield are the two largest drone AI companies in the US and I think in the world today. We were seed in Shield. Because it was West Coast, I met those founders first. I shared that deal with a group called Homebrew, two wonderful, wonderful GPs there. And Homebrew, Satya is on a board now with me. They've been wonderful collaborators. But they'll share back with us. By the way, we've done this around the world. So we'll see opportunities in London. And, you know, we share that with VC friends in London because we don't necessarily want to lead there. So, you know, we ended up with an amazing company that we sold to Canva. In fact, the founder of that company now runs Canva Europe, Middle East, and Africa, which we showed to a fund called Local Globe. And Local Globe, so there's been a lot of seed stage collaboration for very natural reasons. And much of that is because my preference is to lead in the jurisdictions where we are truly local. That being said, we do travel to the Bay Area and to the West Coast a lot. I was just in L.A. With Chris Dixon and speaking at the Upfront conference, which Mark Sister arranges, one of the best VC conferences in the world.
David, we could talk all day. There's tons more here that I'd love to chat to you about, but I'm going to save one final question for you. You're still passionate about South Africa. You still come out here often. We know the country's going through a difficult time at the moment. You're watching things from a remote perspective. What are your thoughts on South Africa today? How concerned are you about the direction the country has taken, and how positive are you that we're going to get things right?
Yeah, look, I think the people of South Africa are just incredible. I know it's easy for me to say this. I do get back. As I said, I've gotten back about three times in the last 8 months. And just everyone that I interact with is impressive. And by the way, this is service staff at a restaurant or nursing staff and doctors in a hospital. You look at the new generation in South Africa, and it's just hard not to be impressed in terms of your day-to-day interactions. There is no question in my mind that the government has been very disappointing. The South Africa's government has let its population down. And I think that South Africa deserves a government that really does work for its people. And so I'm very frustrated with that. A lot of my frustration stems, frankly, again, from Next Up. You know, Subhadri Naidu, our CEO, was, you know, lifelong and is lifelong ANC, is an insider. She's, you know, she's just very connected, very informed. And, you know, it's just hard not to look at the failure in terms of employment creation and so many other basics that I think a government owes its population. and go, South Africa is doing great. South Africa deserves, frankly, I couldn't care who it is, but it deserves a better government. So I say that with insight, empathy, and frustration. I just hope that, that's what this election result ends up doing. Because if I look at the smarts, the savvy, the energy, and the temperament of South Africans, I'm amazed. I'm amazed that South Africans still have, for the most part, the demeanor that they do to just start every day generally like with a smile, with some kind of positive demeanor. It's remarkable given you know what's going on there. So South Africa deserves better.
David, it's been wonderful catching up with you. Let's not wait another 30 years to to do this. If anyone wants to keep up with you, you keep quite an active account on what is now called X, used to be called Twitter. I strongly suggest that anyone who's interested in following your career and the investments that that Founder Collective is making and the things that are interesting to you, you do share those quite actively on X. And your profile there, if I'm not mistaken, is D.A. Frankel, is that right?
Yeah, DM me there anytime. David at Founder Collective, whatever works best for you.
Really good to see you, David, and thanks so much for sharing your insights and reminiscing about the Internet Solutions days and telling us all about what you've been up to. I think our audience is going to love this conversation. So thank you so much.
Duncan, thanks so much for taking the time with me. Really appreciate it. And it's lovely to see you again.